Hello and welcome to the Euromoney Online Channels podcast for February 2013. This month, we've managed to persuade Bob Parker of Credit Suisse and Gabriel Stein of Stein Brothers to sit down with Euromoney Conference's editor Mark Johnson and give him their views on the markets for 2013. Later on in the month, I'll be sitting down with Gabriel and Bob and talking to them about oil and markets in the Middle East. But now, Mark Johnson, who, somewhat surprisingly, starts with the weather.
Hasn't been that brilliant this year, but the mood music in markets certainly has been really rather remarkable. We are seeing S&P and other major stock indices at five-year highs. Bond markets are booming in many ways in terms of issuance. Bob, have we escaped the risk-on, risk-off cycle of last year?
I think the answer to that is probably yes. If we look at what has happened so far in 2013, I think the key feature of markets has been a very significant retail and institutional capital flow into global equity markets, and actually particularly into those markets which either lagged last year, for example, China, in Europe, Italy, which was an underperformer. This year so far, it is one of the top performing markets in Europe. So I think capital flows into those markets which underperformed, also capital flows into markets where we are seeing very significant policy change, and obviously I'm referring to Japan, which has been one of the best performing markets in the last 2 to 3 months, reflecting the change and the expected changes in monetary and fiscal policy there.
And I want to interrogate you on those issues in more detail later, but is this then just a weight of money phenomenon?
I think it's partly the weight of money. It's partly the fact that investors now realise that other asset classes, such as money market funds, bond positions, the yields are exceptionally low. So it's being driven by the lack of attraction of other asset classes relative to equities. I also think it's being driven by a perception, in my view, rightly, that extreme event risk in the global economy and in global markets relative to 1 year ago is significantly reduced. And I also think it's a reflection of an expectation that we are actually going to see slow progress in terms of economic growth and corporate earnings. But it's progress rather than what we saw over the last 2 to 3 years, which was obviously severe economic risk and a downturn in corporate earnings.
Let's just turn to the fundamentals there in a sense. We don't want to spend too much time on the Eurozone or indeed the US fiscal cliff, but do you think that the corner has been turned on either of those?
I think largely progress has been made on the fiscal cliff. Obviously, there is still a decision to be made on cutting public expenditure, and if a positive decision is not achieved between the Democrats and the Republicans, then come March there will be automatic public expenditure cuts of about $110 billion. But the debt ceiling has been extended, albeit only to May. And we had the agreement at the beginning of January, which the markets quite rightly rallied on that agreement. In terms of the Eurozone, I think the market is telling us a very clear picture, which is that we've seen this significant rally in what were very stressed sovereign bond markets. And you know, if one looks at the spread, for example, Spain versus Germany, Italy versus Germany, those spreads are now at 1 year lows.
Gabriel, I mean, as Bob says, the market's sending out a clear signal, but the market's got it wrong before. Do you share Bob's relatively sanguine view?
In the sense that 2013 should be better than 2012 and 2014 even better, yes. We've clearly moved, for instance, if you look at what investors are doing, we're moving from return of capital to return on capital. And I suppose you could say, well, that means it's risk on, but not necessarily slipping back to risk off. I would agree also that the tail risk of events has diminished, but it's still there. What worries me is mainly in the euro area, the danger that something will come up, and we won't know where it comes from. Could it have been the issue of a bailout for Cyprus? Well, apparently, according to today's Frankfurter Allgemeine, the Germans are going to pay, so that won't be the issue. What about the Monte dei Paschi scandal in Italy? Could that threaten Mario Draghi's position at the ECB? And if that happens, what does that do to markets and so on? So the risk is there, and what's worrying is that we don't really know where it comes from. I still think that in the very long run, whatever that may be, a number of years, the euro area, well, history of monetary unions is quite clear. A monetary union between roughly equal-sized economies must either be policed constantly by the strongest economy, in this case Germany, or become a political union. I don't think the Germans are prepared to police the euro area forever, and I don't think it would be acceptable to other countries, but I also don't think that political union is acceptable to the voter taxpayer in Northern Europe as long as the Southern European countries are in. So you have a dichotomy there. And to some extent, that's true also of the US fiscal issues. I don't care very much about the fiscal cliff, or as someone has called it, the fiscal bunny slope. Fiscal policy and its impact on output growth is pretty limited. But clearly, long-term, the U.S. has to decide, are they going to be what they tax themselves to be, a small government economy, or what they spend themselves to be, a large government economy? And that has to be addressed at some stage. But for this year, they're just going to keep postponing and pushing forward the limits. And that should be extremely good news, in particular for U.S. risk assets, and I think ultimately for the US dollar as well. So you could have a virtuous circle there where inflows into the dollar benefits, in particular, equities. Fixed income, I think, is going to do badly. And that in turn attracts further capital flows, and that boosts the dollar and so on and so forth.
Well, let's talk about equities, which Bob mentioned earlier. Is the uptick in key equity markets such as the US and some of those of the Eurozone really underpinned by good prospects on earnings, for example, and fundamental economic activity, underlying economic activity?
I think you have to look at this on a country-by-country basis. I would say in the United States, perhaps a little bit premature. On the other hand, I told Stein Brothers clients early in the autumn that 2013 would be a year when you should get out of bonds and into U.S. equities. So it's a question of how forward-looking they are. Some EA markets ought clearly to do better than others based on economic fundamentals. Germany is one. On the other hand, France really should do badly based on economic fundamentals, as really should Spain. I mean, we've just seen Spanish GDP published for the fourth quarter, worse than expected. Spain is constantly failing to achieve its fiscal targets. That's no surprise, but they're going to get easier targets, which I would have thought is actually bad news. It might be good news in the long run for Spanish equities, but in the short run, it makes everyone say things must be much worse than we thought. And there are some good market prospects outside the euro area. I mean, Sweden is interesting. The Swedish economy is slowing, but in an unattractive bunch of countries, it's less unattractive than many others.
Boring but interesting at the same time, as always with Sweden.
Thank you.
Bob, your clients, how are you advising them in terms of key stock markets?
Well, I think the first point to make is to be long or overweight global equity markets. Now, then you have to break it down by sector, by region, stroke country, and also by market capitalization. I think, you know, in terms of regions, I think you're going to see continued outperformance by the Asian markets. And although Southeast Asia performed very strongly last year, a number of markets, such as the Philippines, such as Thailand, saw returns last year close to 30%. I don't think you're going to see those sort of returns again in 2013, but you could easily see Southeast Asia outperform and, you know, generate returns of close to 10% in 2013. I think the very interesting market is China. China was one of the few markets in 2012 which generated a negative return. I mean the domestic market as opposed to the Hong Kong market. And one's got a situation in China where domestic investors are long cash, and I think you will see domestic capital flows go into the equity market. You're seeing growth moving.
Is there any particular reason why it will? Just because they're following momentum, or because there are changes in property?
Well, I think first of all, interest rates in China are low and will stay low.
They've always been low for a long time.
Therefore, money market and bond returns will be mediocre. The equity market is undervalued relative to history, relative to other markets. The economy, I think, will easily move back to 8% plus growth. And I think the negative sentiment
Real 8% growth rather than artificially managed 8% growth?
That is going to be a real 8% growth, driven by domestic consumption, also by investment spending being maintained at current levels. And, of course, the Chinese economic model has changed to reduce its dependency on the U.S. But having said that, the recovery in economic growth in the U.S. is not going to be harmful for China. So I think China will be an outperformer. In Europe, whereas in 2012, if you were concentrated in the German market and actually Scandinavia as well, you did very well. I think the theme in Europe for 2013 is actually going to be what we have seen so far in 2013, which is this catch-up effect of markets which underperformed last year, like Italy. And despite the dire economic data, I actually would not write off the Spanish equity market, which obviously was one of the worst performing equity markets last year. Elsewhere in emerging markets relative to developed markets, I do think that the theme this year is actually going to be, in contrast to the last 2 years, an outperformance of emerging markets relative to developed markets. By sector, I think you've got to take profits on some of the very defensive sectors, which did very well last year, like utilities, like consumer staple stocks. A number of sectors which are cheap and attractive in an improved economic environment. Obviously, the materials sector, industrials, and I think we will see a switch from defensives to cyclicals.
As Bob says, many stock markets are playing catch-up after underperformance last year. Well, you can't say that of the bond markets. Many credit markets, emerging markets, had a pretty good year last year. Are we heading for a bubble in those key sectors?
Well, I think in the major bond markets, define bubble, but we are, if you define one as prices being unsustainably high, I would say that we are already in one, which is pretty normal. If you assume that current interest rate levels are not the new normal, that means that when economies revive, central banks will raise interest rates, and that will have an effect at the short end, and usually should have an effect on along the entire yield curve. So the question then becomes, will central banks actually start to raise interest rates? Well, I don't think they will do it in 2013, but it will be clear that policy is shifting, and as policy shifts, the natural flow should be out of bond markets and out of money markets. And, of course, that becomes, in a sense, a self-fulfilling movement, because if you start to move, then you've got to make sure that you have a first-mover advantage. I'm putting my money where my mouth is on this one. I'm moving out of bonds and into equities, and I dare say this move, well, we've already seen this move started last year. We've seen bond yields, at least in the advanced economies, touching multi-year highs and likely to rise. And let's also be clear that this sounds...
Bond yields are rising and are going to rise.
Bond prices are going to come down. Yeah. But actually, in some ways, higher interest rates are not necessarily part of the problem, but also part of the solution in future years, because you do have, there is an enormous amount of capital, particularly pension capital, in countries with bad demographics that are looking for some form of yield. Now, how that plays out, they'll be attracted into bonds with higher yields, which then, therefore, that leads to lower yields and so on. But ultimately, higher interest rates, in order to provide the pensions that have been promised or held out, are are almost a must. So, and in most countries, actually, households have normally larger interest income than interest expenditure, and will therefore also benefit.
The forgotten people, savers.
Yeah, absolutely. There was a savings glut before the crisis, so in some countries you need less savings, but in other countries you need more savings, and that rebalancing is helped by higher interest rates.
Indeed, and I want to return to that. But first, Bob, I'd like you to build on what Gabriel said. Looking at credit assets, can you break out the supply and demand in credit assets, be they corporate bonds, high yield bonds,
yes,
emerging market, and then go on to your view on the general monetary sure. stance that we're likely to see?
I think the first point to make is that we've actually had a corporate credit rally since November 2008. And I think it's interesting that actually the corporate bond market started to rally just 2 months after the Lehman failure. We're now in a situation where corporate spreads, including high yield, are close to the low levels that we saw back in the period 2004 to 2007. So we've had a very significant rally in corporate and high yield, and for that matter, in emerging debt. And, you know, in 2013, I suspect that the returns that we've seen in the last 4.5 years in corporate bond markets are not going to be repeated. Now, the obvious question is, are we going to see a reversal in corporate bond markets, and are those spreads going to widen back out? And I would argue we're going to go through a period probably similar to 2003 to 2006, where corporate bond spreads stay at a low level, volatility in the corporate bond market actually falls, and we have a period of sideways movement. But if the question is...
Simply because so many of the bonds are locked up?
I think partly that they're locked up, partly because many investors are uncomfortable with the risk switch out of bond markets into equity markets. And although equity markets are cheap relative to bond markets, you're not going to have all investors doing that automatic switch.
Some in fact can't.
Exactly, they're not allowed by their guidelines. So I think the outlook for 2013 is that actually corporate bond spreads, high yield spreads, and for that matter emerging debt, probably we just trade sideways. And I think one feature of the markets is going to be a continued low level of corporate defaults. And I just don't see, a massive transfer of cash out of corporate bond markets. I think a lot of that money is fairly stable money in the market.
Are you, talking about credit, are you worried by the rise of, or let's say the return? You've seen it before. You've been around long enough to see the growth of structured products,
sure.
the growth of various forms of covenant-lite loans,
yes.
high-yield bonds, payment in kind, etc. If you read the pages of the Capital Market of your Euroweek, you see those are coming back.
Absolutely.
Are you worried by that?
As at now, no. We might have a different conversation in perhaps a year's time. But you know, what we're seeing so far, obviously, has been a significant increase in the issuance of collateralized loans. Most of those, the collateral is actually corporate loans, where I come back to my earlier point,
so,
where
yes.
the default rate is low. And I think, you know, two aspects which are positive is, first of all, the transparency of structured products today is good. Whereas if we go back to 2006 and 2007, the transparency and the quality of the collateral was exceptionally poor. And one actually had to ask the question, did investors fully understand what they were buying back in 2006 and 2007?
The answer to many did.
And I think we all know the answer to that. I think the other issue is quality of collateral. What are going to be the default rates? And where structured products have hit problem after problem in the past is that the quality of collateral has been very poor, whether it was corporate bonds in 2001, 2002, whether it was the disasters with subprime mortgage collateral in 2008 and 2009. As at today, collateral quality actually seems reasonably good. So I'm not anticipating, at least for 2013, any major problems. And as I say, I hope that that will be the situation for quite a long period to come.
Gabriel, can you share that?
Yeah, I do. I think one of the changes now, and Bob alluded to this, is we know more about what these papers are. The problem in the mid-noughties...
But do investors learn?
Yes and no. Investors learn and then forget, or they think this time it's different, which it never is. But the point is, in the run-up, when these devices, when these papers were, or when the widespread was new, it was assumed, you know, you look, it sounded so seductive. There's the risky tranche and the less risky tranche and the mezzanine and this, that, and the other. And if you're at the top tranche, you're fine. And, of course, that was when sovereign bonds were also risk-free. Remember those days? Well, now we know they're not. Now we know that whichever tranche you're in, it can be very risky. So you take a more, hopefully, a more cautious attitude. The people who produce these take a more cautious attitude, at least you hope. So from that perspective, yeah, I would share Bob's optimism, definitely.
Well, can I turn back to monetary policy? Gabriel, if I can paraphrase, said that he sensed a shift in the general mood towards monetary policy across major, major economies, but not yet any significant tightening. Is that Credit Suisse's take on
The answer to that is broadly yes, but I think one has to be more specific in answering your question. First of all, in the case of Japan, I think we are clearly seeing a further easing in monetary policy with a move to a 2% inflation target. And I would actually argue that is very positive for Japan because it hopefully will correct, and I think it will, the major problem of the Japanese economy over the last 10, 20 years, which has been deflation. And Japan needs to get back to inflation out of deflation. So that change in monetary policy in Japan, I think, is that easing in policy will continue probably for a good 2 years. If we look at the United States, the statements from the Federal Reserve have been very clear, which is that interest rates will stay at these exceptionally low levels until there is a significant improvement in unemployment. And they have set a target of 6.5% unemployment. And we are, although the labor market in America is improving, you know, as at today, we're still in the high sevens for unemployment. So there's still a lot of progress to be made in improving the US labor market. So I think the Fed will do what it said, keep interest rates at current levels for a good 1 to 2 years. Now, the interesting question for the Fed is when do they start to unwind quantitative easing? And in my discussions with central bankers, when one asks that question, what happens when QE is reversed? When will QE be reversed? Frankly, you get some very opaque answers. And I actually don't think that the central banking community is yet prepared for the time when QE has to be unwound. And I think that probably is correct, because any unwinding of QE will probably only start very slowly, very moderately, and probably towards the back end of 2014. I don't think you're going to see an unwinding of QE in 2013. That doesn't mean they're going to do more, but it's going to be on hold.
It seems to me that guessing when the gears shift on monetary policy in the major economies is complicated by the fact that we no longer have the certainty about central banking that we did, say, 5-10 years ago, when we thought an independent central bank, which, whether it inflation targeted explicitly or not, did have a central mandate to control inflation. We're now, all around the world, that has been debated, whether it's a political thing in Japan, an intellectual issue in the United States, or indeed in the United Kingdom with the advent of Kat Carney. How much do you think that makes it harder for bond investors particularly to understand what's going on within central banks?
Well, I think bond investors face a market environment of low official interest rates, low market rates, narrow corporate bond, high yield and emerging debt spreads. And I think the trend is going to be one of slow backup in government bond yields. I think it's also going to be a slow trend of reversal of capital out of perceived safe havens, such as the US Treasury market, the Bund market, the Swiss government bond market. I think the capital is going to be slowly withdrawn there. And, you know, if you actually ask the question, how are investors going to make money in fixed income markets over the next 1 to 2 years, actually I struggle to give you a positive reply to that question.
Because well, I was going to ask you that shortly, so I won't now. You've said you can't answer it.
Well, I can answer it, because I think actually the returns in global fixed income markets, at best, are going to be very small positive returns. Right. And I think in certain G4 government bond markets, particularly the long end, we are probably going to see negative returns being generated.
Right, indeed. Gabriel, to come back to the debate about what a central bank is, what it does, you've thought long and hard about the nature of central banking. You've written about it.
Yeah, it's... it's interesting. We are seeing this debate that you alluded to about the shift in what central banks do and should not do. I think, let me start by saying central bank policy and central bank targets should not be sacrosanct. You operate a certain central banking regime because it works, and if it manifestly does not work, you should abandon it. On the other hand, you have to balance...
How long can you do that? Over what kind of time frame can you do that, though? Because... investors, market watchers want some kind of certainty.
Well, there should be a debate. There should be transparency in that there should be a debate over what to do and what not to do. Okay. So, but you can operate the policy, as I said, for however long it works. If it works forever, you presumably follow it forever, but that's a very long time, and we haven't seen that yet. That being said, you have to balance it against... credibility, and that's of course a nebulous concept, but central banks have to have it. And central banks have now spent a lot of time saying what we can do is we can keep prices stable and thereby provide the best possible environment for output growth, and we can do this using only one instrument. if like me you studied economics before 1980, you know that central banks had loads of instruments. But if you studied economics after 1980, you know that central banks only have one instrument, and when therefore they were thrown into a new situation, they had to develop unconventional ideas, which, as said, I'm sure Bob was perfectly familiar with what's called quantitative easing and so on, was debt market operations. So you have the issue of doing something that works versus the credibility of suddenly saying, for the past 10 years we've told you that this is right, and you know what, we were wrong. Now we're telling you that that is right. Mm-hmm. And believe us, because this time we know what we're talking about. That's not going to work. So therefore you do need an open debate. From that perspective, I think it's very interesting that Governor Carney has started this debate, or rather restarted, because in Britain we've always had people like Sir Sam Britton and so on who want a switch to nominal GDP targeting. And as it happens, I think inflation targeting and even price level targeting are far superior to nominal GDP targeting. I think nominal GDP targeting is a very bad idea. This is a measure that you cannot measure in truth, that is constantly revised, not to mention every 5 years it's constantly revised also, depending on which country. And so however you do things, however much you talk about forward-looking policy, it's going to be a rearward-looking policy, and therefore it becomes a bad idea. But the discussion is there, and if we come up with something which is much better than inflation targeting, we should shift to that. That being said, I am still of the view that with the instruments they have at their disposal, with the fact that central banks cannot do everything, I do think that inflation or price level targeting are the best things they can do in current circumstances, and that they should concentrate on that with one proviso. I very strongly feel that central banks should be prepared to lean against the wind in an asset price bubble. And there, of course, we did have a long debate at the one end of which was the Fed, which said, you never know when a bubble is a bubble. All you have to do is clean up afterwards. And at the other edge, you had people like the Riksbank in Sweden and the Reserve Bank of Australia said, no, you have to lean against the wind. And I think everyone, including the Fed, is now aware of that. And that, of course, does mean occasionally you have to raise interest rates when there's no inflation, or you have to mandate forced amortization of loans or loan-to-value ratios and so on. And that is, of course, never going to be politically welcome, which is why it's perhaps better if it's done by an independent central bank.
Which, of course, raises the interesting question, what type of inflation, when you say when there's no inflation, if you've got asset price rises, one person's inflation is another person's wealth creation, effectively.
Well, it is, and you can never... it puts a premium on central bank communication strategy to explain why, let us say, 5% house price rise good, 10% house price rise bad, or 10% equity price rise good, 25 very bad, or whatever it might be.
Indeed.
But I think, you know, the key question on central bank policy is I don't think you're going to see a major shift away from inflation targeting, but there will be much more focus, particularly by those central banks like the UK, like the Federal Reserve. There's going to be much more focus on trying to define when we have damaging asset bubbles, yeah, most notably in the real estate market, but also in credit markets as well for corporate and consumer lending. And, you know, most central bankers, I think, do accept that if one looks back at 2006 and 2007, the focus just on inflation targeting and almost ignoring the asset bubbles, yeah, was a major policy mistake.
But they didn't all, sorry, I know you wanted to, but they didn't all do it. I mean, take the Reserve Bank of Australia, which to my mind is one of the best central banks in the world. They said back in 2002, okay, we've got no inflation, but we've got a real estate problem. We're raising interest rates, and started to raise, and partly because of this, Australia is one of the few countries to have escaped, one of the few advanced economies to have escaped through the Great Recession without having a recession. So they didn't all. And I think the other thing I think is extremely interesting is development in Sweden, where the Riksbank a couple of years ago said, okay, we're going to have to intervene more actively in financial markets. Therefore, we'd better have a portfolio on our balance sheet at different maturities so we don't have to scramble around when push comes to shove. Very interesting,
say,
very forward-looking.
Debt market operations, but that has caused them quite a bit of political friction, yeah, within that country, as you well know. I want to end this bit by asking you, we've talked about lessons from this crisis. Mm. I want you in one sentence to your own personal lesson from living through this particular cycle. And let's hope it is a cycle and we're now at the end of it.
Well, I've been in financial markets now for 40 years, and I've actually lost count of the number of market crises that I have managed money through. I think that if one looks at 2008, the financial crisis, relative to other crises, whether it's the Asian crisis of 97, the stock market collapse in 87 and in 73, I think that if one makes a list of criteria of how bad a crisis is, I think one can argue very strongly that 2008 was probably the worst crisis. But most crises, if you study them, are driven by excess leverage and asset bubbles prior to the crisis, and inevitably those bubbles burst. And it's just a question of what is the damage that's created. Indeed. From bubbles bursting. Sorry, that wasn't one sentence.
Well, no, but a good point all the same.
Look at money supply data and credit data. That covers the leverage issue, because Bob is absolutely right. And for God's sake, look at history. It's amazing how many financial market actors believe that ancient history is what happened 3 or 5 years ago. No, 2007 could have been handled better if more people had known what happened in 1907 and so on. Look at the history.
Most
of the past.
People don't even know there was a crisis in 1907, do they?
Well, there certainly, as you know, there was one. It led to the creation of the Fed, among other things. But look at how past crises appeared, and never ever believe that this time it's different and we've abolished the cycle, because it's
absolutely
never true.
So, and this question, the final question you are going to have to answer in one sentence, if you could have one economist sitting, a book by one economist sitting on your bedside table, who would it be and why?
Oh, a book by one economist.
One economist's book, shall we say, leading book.
Possibly right now, Rogoff and Reinhardt, this time it's different.
This time it's different, and that is self-explanatory. Mm. Oh.
I actually like reading the work by Rubini, largely because actually I disagree with him most of the time.
Right, okay. Hopefully he doesn't send you to sleep. Thank you very much, both of you, for a very interesting and useful run through what we might expect in 2013 and perhaps what we might not. Thank you.
That about wraps it up for our first podcast of 2013. Do subscribe, there'll be plenty more coming, and thank you for listening right until the end.